to tell the truth, you better wake up, man, or be a part of a pernicious plan. And I won't soon forget the heroes that took up a stand for the Constitution.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show, where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD in Johnson City, Tennessee. Welcome back to our second episode on the National Archives. We're in the middle of a field trip to the headquarters of the National Archives, where the so-called Charters of Freedom are displayed. And these charters include the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and of course, the original seven articles of the United States Constitution. During our last episode, we talked at great length with Kitty Nicholson, who is one of those archivists who actually preserves and protects the Constitution on a daily basis. Kitty shared with us some fascinating tales about that process and about how the Constitution's been protected for the last 200 years. We're going to resume our conversation with Kitty, and we'll also talk to some other people who were visiting the National Archives when I was there.
We knew in the early 90s that we had a problem, not a terrible problem, but a problem that needed attention. Then we found out by the mid-90s that they were going to close the building for some period. And that's what you have to do. You have to say, we have a problem, and we see the window when we can deal with these, because we can't take them off display.
It sounds like to me like you guys plan everything well in advance, which makes me feel very good about the fact that I called in advance for this interview.
I'm glad you did, too. Absolutely.
All right.
So what we did, and you know, I mentioned at that time, or maybe I didn't, at that time only page 1 and page 4 were on display of the Constitution because there wasn't room enough, plus the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. So you had four parchments on display. We knew that we wanted to make it accessible. Those kids had to stand on a little stepping. There's a little sort of step stool that you could stand on if you weren't, you know, 4 feet tall. If you're in a wheelchair, there were stairs. You couldn't get up there. So there was a whole plan to make them more accessible. But we realized we needed a running start. We had three parchments not on display, page 2, page 3, and the transmittal page. And so we started work in the late 1998, with those pages not on display. And then, come 2001, we knew our techniques, we had everything lined up, and we had 2 years left to get page 1, page 4, Declaration, Bill of Rights taken care of. But at that point, we knew our
okay, and so you actually opened up the cases.
Right.
And somebody had to actually handle the physical documents.
Right.
Were you here at that time?
Absolutely. So
did you get to actually touch them?
I did, actually.
You are one
yes.
of like a handful of people in the world who've actually touched this stuff.
For 50 years.
Can I touch you?
Yes,
okay.
You can. Well,
oh,
okay,
see,
now
I've got one step removed right. from actually touching it now.
Okay. I touched all of those documents, actually.
Wow.
So it was a great, I never would have dreamed that project would come to be, or that I would be involved in it, but it was a great honor and privilege. And
wow, you're one of a handful of Americans who's actually touched these Charters of Freedom. Because, of course, everybody who signed them is long gone.
They're gone.
And it's been since the 50s since anybody else had an open case.
Right.
Well, I'm curious now, what did you replace them with? You took them out of the old confinement. So what are they? And I imagine this was the last time it was done, right?
Correct.
So this is the current protective coding.
We worked with the old encasements were done by the National Bureau of Standards, and we worked with they're now called the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Okay.
So we work with scientists and expert engineers and fabricators there, and they fabricated a very high-tech and state-of-the-art encasement that can be opened, which is one of our requirements.
Mm-hmm.
It's bolted together, but you can open it. It has inlet and outlet valves that allow us to feed in more of the inert gas. We chose a new inert gas, argon, which is
argon.
A larger
okay.
molecule.
Can we go into that a little bit? Now, why in particular argon? Helium, you said, we kept oxygen out. That was the first thing. Okay, so we had helium and a little bit of moisture.
A little bit of moisture, right.
And now we want to go with argon. Now, what's better about argon?
Well, helium's a very small molecule. If you can remember back to the periodic chart,
it's the second one, isn't
it? It's pretty small, okay. Right. So helium, and this is kind of amazing, but you may remember also that glass is actually a kind of a super chilled glassy mixture. Mm-hmm. It actually has pores.
Mm-hmm.
And some glass...
Oh, helium can get out through the glass.
Helium can actually escape out through...
balloons.
Right.
That's why when you take the balloon
that's
pump...
Why
right,
helium
that's...
balloons will not hold helium. Right.
Of course.
Gets
it
out.
It does the same thing with a glass encasement. Okay.
Some people maintain there could not possibly be helium left. It must have all leaked out. We were pretty sure that was not the case. And we had one... I mentioned there was a free glass and then an outer glass, and one of them had actually those Newton rings on it, and we mm-hmm. figured that was the one that had possibly some partial leakage, but none of the other ones showed that. And we actually, one of our goals in our project was to confirm that there was still helium inside of each one of them, and that sounds easy to do, but it's very, very hard to do. You have to sample the gas without any contamination from the atmosphere. So we worked with a physicist.
You couldn't just pop it open.
Well, you could, but then you would never know.
No, you'd never know, right.
So we really had to know. And we were able to capture the gas within each of the encasements and confirm that they all still retained helium. One of them had showed partial evidence of minor leakage, but it still had helium in it. Hmm. But we didn't want helium leaking in our new ones, and we chose argon with a small amount of helium. You can do some leak testing with helium, and if the helium's leaking, you know it's a very small leak, but basically they're filled with humidified argon. Again, any inert gas displaces, enough has flowed in to displace the atmosphere, and there's no oxygen
left. And you actually have now input and outtake valves.
Correct.
So that you can actually control and adjust if the humidity goes up or down.
Well, we seal them with, we put a measured amount of partial pressure of water into, water mist, I should say, into the encasements to approximate what we thought was the bare minimum to keep them flexible, but not to allow them to get desiccated.
Right.
So that's roughly equivalent to what we would say about 40, 42% relative humidity.
Very interesting.
Now, when we had them open, just to allude to the constitution, we talked about what good condition it really is in. We examined every single letter under a special binocular microscope looking for those lifted flakes of ink. And there are some lifted flakes of ink. There were. And so one of our main concerns was to consolidate the ink. We didn't want any flake that was in place but lifting up to break off. And so we used it's essentially a part, what we call parchment size. It's like gelatin. It's a liquid. When it's warm and when it cools, it congeals and is hard. So we would feed in at body temperature. We'd hold a little flask, tiny little bottle in our hand to keep it warm, and feed tiny little droplets about the size of the comma or period at the end of a sentence under that lifting flake. And because of the warmth and moisture, it would relax the flake, and it would fall down or move down into place and be held by capillarity and then be adhered down. So that was the major treatment we did on the constitution.
So this is like microscopic gluing down of things.
Tiny little drops. We were doing it under this binocular microscope that would be used, say, for eye operations.
That is detail work.
Very detailed
work. Do you actually do that sort of thing?
Yes. We did that. We took turns.
So you'll actually be sitting at this thing?
Sitting line by line, letter by letter, going just consistently all the way down, looking for a lifting flake, setting it down, looking for the next lifting flake, setting it down.
You don't want to screw that up, do you?
No, you want
to
do it very...
Oops.
No, we don't change the word.
Yes,
don't change the word.
Right.
We didn't change any punctuation. The one other thing we had to do on the Constitution, on one of the inner pages, we'll have to check if it's two or three, there was a tear at the bottom edge, and it had been pulled together kind of crudely and overlapped a bit, and so we repaired that tear using the typical techniques that we would use, which is a very thin handmade Japanese paper, mm-hmm. and adhesive, again, the parchment size. And then one of its virtues was it set very quickly. You didn't mm-hmm. have to worry about having it dry slowly.
So you had I'm sure when you had these casements open back in, was 2001, you said? Or
right.
thereabouts? You had probably a list of things you wanted to do while things were open.
Right.
And then you got through your whole list in that time.
We did a very careful examination right. and a condition report. And in that condition report, we outlined what we thought needed to be done. And then the last thing was that they were not flat. They had gotten sort of a washboard, sort of hills
right.
and valleys distortion. And so we humidified each of the parchments and then flattened it so that it would, under pressure, under weighted blotters, mm-hmm. Very, very slowly with felts and weights, and then allowed them to equilibrate in that new flat conformation. So they are now quite a bit flatter than they were while they were on display in the old
casements.
Yeah,
if you display them at any kind of angle other than perfectly horizontal, I mean, they could tend to do that, couldn't they?
Well, it was actually the fact that there was this piece of glass resting on them,
mm-hmm.
And they weren't perfectly flat to start with.
Ah, okay.
So they are actually displayed at a low angle.
Yeah.
It's sufficient to allow a person in a wheelchair or a small child to be able to see them. They're at about 20 degrees.
That was one of my favorite parts of looking at the Constitution, was actually leaning over the case and having my nose practically pressed against the glass. Not quite, but the guard was watching me. But you can get very close.
You can look
at these you're inches away from these signatures.
You can see them really, really well. One of the other things, a lot of these changes were to make them more visible and more accessible. We, looking at something in glass can be distracting. You see a lot of reflection,
right.
lights behind you.
Is that why the lights are low in there? Is that one reason?
Well, that's actually another thing. That's to minimize any chance of fading.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a special glass. It's actually a special coating on the glass that's anti-reflective coating.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not seeing your own reflection very much or the reflection of other lights. And because of that, you almost see them as well as if there were no glass at all.
Oh, yeah.
They're very much, much more visible than they used to be. So anyone out there who visited, back when you were a kid and, before this big change in 2001, you should come back because they're much more visible than they used
Absolutely.
To be.
Absolutely. I think everybody should come back every once in a while anyway.
Right.
But
right.
But that's certainly a reason to come back if it's been a while.
But the lights are low in the rotunda to minimize any possibility of fading. We've removed all the oxygen from near the documents,
mm-hmm.
but the light is kept quite low. And you'll notice now there's lighting built into these new exhibit cases. It's fiber optic lighting,
mm-hmm.
and it's filtered to remove the blue and the ultraviolet from the light source because those are the higher energy part of the
mm-hmm.
spectrum. And so there's a slight golden quality to the light, and I like to think
that's not bad.
It's kind of golden glow.
Yeah, that's not bad. Well, before it sounds like we're getting to a good point to go over and look at the documents, but before we do, I've always heard that's one of the reasons that the Declaration is so faded is because apparently it was displayed at the State Department for years in direct sunlight. Is that something that is true? I mean, I'd heard that.
It was displayed for many years, many decades. In the old State War and Navy building, the Declaration was in a case, and the library was displayed, had a skylight. And so
mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly the location and if direct sunlight was coming in. It was displayed also up at the old patent office,
right.
And that was near a window, near the big portico. But I actually went over, I've seen an exhibit floor plan from
mm-hmm.
that exhibit, and it probably didn't get as much light. I think people were worried it was on display too long, but I don't think it was in direct sunlight.
Well, that's good.
So, but many other things happen, and I think there is concern that the copyists who were trying to copy the document could possibly have also caused some damage. It's hard. There's just no solid evidence, so we can't say that for a fact.
Well, it sounds like a very good time for us to move over and look at the actual rotunda and the charters
let's
of freedom.
That.
And so let's go over there and do that.
Great.
Great.
Okay, we've stopped on our way over to the rotunda. I'm here with Kitty, and she is she's brought me to something called a quarter model, which is going to show us the actual the encasement, right?
It shows how the encasement's put together. And what you see on the top is this what looks like a traditional gold leaf frame. And it looks very, very traditional. But underneath, it's very, very high tech. The bottom is it's milled out of aluminum. The frame is milled out of titanium. And it's got holes for about 70 bolts that bolt the top to the base. And it's got different monitoring devices set in a recess so that you can check the pressure and the temperature and all sorts of things like that. And then what you can see, it's got a cross-section. You can see that the document, and this is, of course, a facsimile, is resting on a piece of paper, and the piece of paper is resting on a platform that's got holes through it all
over.
Like,
it looks like a pegboard you might see
in a
workshop. Yeah.
This is aluminum, and it's got drilled holes. And then that has little legs that attach to the base of the encasement. And there's a space underneath that was to allow some monitoring equipment to shoot a beam of light to try to use a light beam to measure the oxygen and water content. And then you see this thick glass. It's actually a double glass with a laminate layer in between.
But that's about a quarter inch thick, isn't it?
It's about a quarter inch thick. Yeah. You can see there's about an inch standoff down to the document, so the glass doesn't touch the document anymore. And basically, when you see it on display, when we go over to see the display, it looks like it's just floating in this dark black surround because the inside of the base has been anodized black. And so you see the parchment sort of floating in a black space. But actually, it's resting on paper, resting on metal. The little holes allow the inert gas to circulate and the moisture to circulate, so there are no pockets of more moisture or less moisture. So it's all very even.
So it only looks like a picture frame.
It only looks like a picture frame. It's actually a very high-tech accomplishment.
In fact, I have to note here at the bottom of this display is a mirror so that you can look at the bottom of this, and it looks like the inside of a machine.
It does. Really.
Which, of course, it is.
So.
Yeah.
And then there's a bigger cross-section up above, so
you can see
a little
graph
more
behind, yeah.
The graph of how it works. And that, I think, might also be on our website. I'm not sure. But.
Extremely, extremely cool. And by the way, what is your website's address if people want
to? Right. It's www.archives.gov. And you can click on charters or learn more about history, and it takes you. There's a lot of wonderful information there. I hope you've read all the information on the Constitution.
I haven't read it all, but I have
definitely
visited.
But there's a lot of good stuff.
I will be going back, absolutely.
Yeah, really good stuff.
Okay.
So,
once again, the best thing is to come here and see it yourself, but you certainly want to look at the website,
right,
too. Yeah.
The other thing you can hear sort of in the background, there's a video that was made about this whole project, and part of that's shown in our theater, and there's also a loop here that documents
very cool
all the stages of the project.
Okay, well, let's go over and look at the rotunda. Yeah, let's look at them. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're on a field trip to the National Archives. We've been talking to Kitty Nicholson about how she preserves and protects that document every day. After the break, we'll have a quiz, then we'll talk some more with Kitty. Stay tuned.
Article 1 establishes the Congress. It might seem simple, but there's guidelines beyond this. So follow along, y'all. We in for the long haul as I relate the details of congressional protocol. The House of Representatives, yo, it's mad large! 135 representatives in all. They serve for 2 years, bigger states get more. But you can't be a congressman if you're only 24. Now in the upper house of Congress, the one called the Senate, there's 100 senators under the vice president. Two from every state with a 6-year limit. But you gotta be 30 or else you can't.
Well, it's time once again for our constitutional quiz with our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, from the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. How are you, Kelly?
I'm well. How are you, Stuart?
I am doing so well. I'm just excited about how well I am. And we even have a contestant with us here today.
Excellent. And who do we have today, Stuart?
This is Brent Easton. I'm from Canaan Valley, West Virginia.
All right.
Okay, Brent, are you ready for the quiz?
I am.
All right. Kelly, why don't you go ahead and sock him with the question?
All right, Brett, I'm hoping you're a fan of the Bill of Rights because the question is regarding the Bill of Rights. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The Bill of Rights were added to the Constitution. Was it A, during the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, B, in the preamble before Article 1 of the Constitution, C, during the Civil War in 1863, or D, at the end of the text after the seven articles?
Okay, those are some interesting choices. Could you give us the answer choices again, Kelly?
Yeah, I'd like to hear those one more time. I think I know the answer.
All right, Brett, here we go, because this is, you know, we have this great award for you, this great T-shirt that says your weekly constitutional. So let's make sure you're listening. You ready? Here we go. The Bill of Rights were added to the Constitution. Was it A, during the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, B, in the preamble before Article 1, C, during the Civil War in 1863, or D, at the end of the text after the seven articles?
Why don't we go through those in order, Brent? Okay. How about A? Was it added during the Constitutional Convention?
I don't believe it was, no.
Okay. How come? Why do you not think so?
Well, I kind of feel like it was proposed by Madison, I think, in maybe 1790. And I feel like it was...
So you think it was just afterward?
I feel like it was all finalized in 1791, but I'm not sure.
Okay, well then, I guess that would also answer B, so it couldn't have been in the preamble either.
No, not in the preamble.
Okay, what was C again? Was it during the Civil War?
C had to do with the Civil War. It wasn't then. That was much later.
A bit later, so I guess that leaves D.
And what was D one more time?
At the end of the text, after the seven articles.
I guess I'm going to have to go with that.
Okay, is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Kelly, how did you do?
Well, Brett, congratulations. You are a proud owner of your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
Well, that's just marvelous. How do you feel?
Really good.
Really good?
Yeah, big time. I mean,
do you think
Brett, you were really close when you said, you're somewhat close when you said 1790 that James Madison proposed the Bill of Rights, but it actually was earlier than that. It was passed in 1789, September 25th, 1789, so almost 2 years after our Constitution was ratified. And then the Bill of Rights wasn't actually ratified until 1791.
Right, and there was a great deal of controversy about this. One of the major objections of the anti-Federalists, both at the convention and subsequently during the ratification process, was that there was no Bill of Rights. In fact, rather famously, George Mason and several other people who'd been at the convention refused to sign the original seven articles because there was no Bill of Rights. And so in order to convince the anti-Federalists to ratify, many of the proponents of the Constitution, the so-called Federalists, promised that the first order of business of the new Congress would be to pass a Bill of Rights. And that's what they did, just as Kelly just described. And so it was appended at the end of the first seven articles. And in fact, if you go to the National Archives today, you'll see the first seven articles displayed in one case. And then you'll see the Bill of Rights off in a case by itself.
And Stuart, perhaps you can add a little bit more about it. You know, at one point there was a debate of when we amend our Constitution, should we be amending the actual text itself, or are we adding more language, adding amendments to the Constitution? So the answer choice that Brett did a great job answering was we add the Bill of Rights to the end of the text after the seven articles. And why didn't we just include it within the articles?
Well, because they didn't have word processors back then. I think it was basically just to a great extent, just a pragmatic debate. I mean, it's very hard to go back and interpolate language or insert it, so you just tack it on to the end, and that's what we've done with all the 27 amendments, even those that we have first ratified and then repealed, like the 18th Amendment, which was subsequently repealed. And that brings up an interesting modern story, and that is, of course, that recently Congress read the entire Constitution aloud at the beginning of the congressional session. And there was some debate over whether they should read every word of it or they should not read parts of it which had either been specifically repealed or had been effectively repealed by later amendments, and they went with the second approach. There were certain parts of the Constitution that were simply left unread, such as the Fugitive Slave Clause, because they have been effectively changed by, in that case, the 13th Amendment. Anyway, Brent, you did a great job today. Thanks very much. We appreciate your playing. And now, do you think this will increase your chances with the ladies when you wear the T-shirt around?
More than likely, I would say.
Yeah, that happens. That happens a great deal. Okay, thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're at the National Archives. Next, we're going to go into the Rotunda and look at the document itself.
Okay, we are now here in the Rotunda of the National Archives, and we are standing right in front of the Constitution of the United States. It looks like a gold-filled engraving there. It's very, very well done. And then beneath that are the four parchment pages that you described to us earlier, right, Kitty?
Okay. So here we are in front of the new case for the Constitution, four pages. And what's wonderful, and you can see, is they're lower in front, quite a bit lower. And so everyone, adults and children and people in wheelchairs, can all see. There's no impediment, and it's flush. So there's absolutely no impediment to coming up. They appear, as I say, to float in a black surround. And if you get off to the side, you can see the fiber optic lighting, which I think looks kind of neat.
I do, too. It looks almost like a stage mirror.
Or a movie marquee.
A movie marquee, exactly.
Like
right,
yeah.
Right.
The documents, the light is low, but as we were both saying, it's incredibly legible.
Extremely legible. In fact, I'm going to sneak over here. Let's walk over to the page four, if
yes.
we could, which is really my favorite page. And as soon as we have a chance here, we're going to bend over and look. You can actually look, and you can have your nose, you know, about 6 inches away from...
You really can, yeah.
I'm looking right now. I can see Alexander Hamilton. I can see George Washington. I can see Benjamin Franklin. Is there anything you wanted to point out? You said there was
the thing that's kind of neat is on the far left side,
right,
just to the left of the word done,
mm-hmm.
is a little rectangle, and that's the errata. And that's where the mistakes that they made are spelled out so that everyone agreed this is what should have been written. So it's a legal document.
You know, that's extremely important. You know, the people will do that in the same thing when they're negotiating a contract or any sort of important paper. All the people who are signing will say, wait a second, page 32, there's a typo, and then they'll cross it out and initial it and all that stuff.
Exactly.
So they did the same thing with the Constitution.
Very same thing. So, you know, they were smart, they were careful, and they paid a lot of attention to detail. Now, you see at the top edge also the slits I was telling you about.
Oh, yes.
The ribbon would have been laced through. And you know, you don't even notice those. I think most people would walk right by without thinking.
I have looked at this many times, or several times, I should say, and I had never noticed them before, but there they are at the top of page four, the slits, yeah.
Now, you mentioned something about were these rolled up, and you can sort of see on the bottom edge of the fourth page,
mm-hmm.
it's a little dirtier,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of a giveaway telltale sign that something is rolled up, and the outer edge is the edge that gets dirty.
So you see
it there. You also see it on the Declaration of Independence. So probably the fourth page was the last. It was rolled up in sequence, and it got a bit of dirt. And apparently transmittal page, too.
Understood. Yeah, that probably went on the top. I would imagine
probably.
Yeah, probably when they had it all bound together
but
with ribbon.
We don't know when that ribbon went away, and we don't know if they then shuffled the transmittal page to the back because it wasn't so important.
But, understood.
Yeah.
Now, you said there was a place you were going to show me where there was a scraping out
right.
with a penknife.
I'm going to peek over people's shoulders.
Okay, well, I'm following you. That's fine.
Got to get a little closer.
That's fine. We don't want to get in people's... These people have been waiting a long time, and this is important for them to do. We're just going to look over their shoulders as they do it. And you... Now, please don't feel like you have to get out of the way. That's fine. But we're looking at... Page one.
Sorry,
this is the famous one with "We the People" written on
right.
it. Everybody pauses over that. Now, whereabout would be the scraping?
It's near the bottom.
Right?
Near the bottom edge. It's about the fourth or fifth line up.
I see it.
You see it?
There it is.
It looks like a gray smudge.
Yes, it does. It's just a big old gray smudge.
And the reason is the surface is all roughed up, so it holds the grime more.
Right.
So it got a little grimier, and... As I say, the first page is the one that has a lot of ink splotches in particular, and it has that big correction. So it's kind of just a sign he was working fast.
He was working fast indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else you want to tell us?
Anything else we need to look at here?
You can see the big splotch, too. See the two
Yeah, I see several big splotches, right?
They were in a hurry.
They were in a hurry, and that happens when you're in a hurry. Okay. Well, we're standing right next to the Declaration, too. Let's go over there and contrast that, if we could. And everybody who listens to the show knows that they're two very different documents with different functions, but both of them extremely important. And, you know, with all sadness, this is what we're talking about. When you look over here at the Declaration, I mean, it's virtually illegible, much of it.
That's why we have to be grateful that we have the William Stone engraving.
Oh, yes.
Because that's what preserves the
absolutely the
actual writing. And
in the lower left-hand corner, there's a big handprint.
The mysterious handprint.
Yeah, we don't know who did that, do we?
You know, we got a letter once from a woman who said her grandfather had told her that he had worked in the shop where this happened.
Right.
But we've not been able to verify that. So it's an interesting story, but we don't have real
It happened long. We can't do the Cinderella thing and match the hand up to the handprint.
We
don't know who that is.
Tell you one thing, though.
Yes.
The earliest photographs of the Declaration, there were photographs taken at the end of the 19th century by a man named Mr. Handy, and he took great big glass plate negatives. They are lost. And if anyone has a big 19th century photograph of the Declaration of Independence, it would be really important to see, is the handprint there? What was the date of the photograph? That would help us narrow it down.
So we're looking for the photographs, the missing photographs. Okay,
right.
And they would send them to you, right?
They could send me a letter.
And what's your email?
My email is catherine.nicholson@nara.gov.
Okay, Catherine with a K.
With a C.
With a C. Okay. Well, okay. Glad I asked that.
Okay.
With a
so,
C.
I'm just saying that because I'm sure those photographs are out there somewhere. But
wouldn't that be great? So everybody, look in your attic. See if you can find the old photograph.
It might help us solve the mystery of when the handprint appears.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kitty. Anything else?
I think that's it.
I guess we should let these good people get up, and they've been waiting in line.
Okay.
Excuse us, okay?
Sorry.
Before we leave, though, can we walk over by the Bill of Rights? Do you mind?
Absolutely.
And let's just walk over there because, of course, that's part of the Constitution as well. Of course, it has a separate identity as the first 10 amendments with all those important individual freedoms. But let's talk a little bit about this as well, since this is part of your job as well.
Okay.
Is it basically the same encasement as the rest of it?
It's the same
technology?
Encasement. It's a little bit larger because the document is a little bit larger. We decided, though, one person pressed, he wanted all of them to be this size so they'd all be interchangeable. But these are heavy, heavy things.
Right.
And it would have been just that much heavier. So we didn't want to make every single one as big and heavy as this.
Right.
Now, you'll notice this is actually not in as good condition as the Constitution.
Yeah.
But not as bad as the Declaration.
It's just kind of in the middle here.
It's kind of in the middle. It has a lot of modeling. The color's uneven. It might have gotten mold damage.
Right.
But it is still legible.
Yes, very much so. And these, of course, were many of those very important things, you know, First Amendment freedoms of speech and religion, and the Fourth Amendment search and seizure, and Fifth, Sixth, and Sixth Amendments. All this is right here.
Mm-hmm. One thing is everyone assumes that the Bill of Rights is just 10 amendments, because that's what were ratified originally, because two of them were controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's all 12.
Right.
And they were sent out for ratification.
No, you're correct.
There are varying combinations of approval. And as you know, I know this because we have volumes of the ratification documents sent back by various states. But Massachusetts was one of the last to ratify because it thought there weren't enough protections.
For heaven's sake.
And if that ratification notification came on a piece of Massachusetts state letterhead signed by Governor Saltonstall.
For heaven's sake.
So that's 20th century. It's kind of amazing.
That is amazing. And what's also amazing is that one of those proposals there was not ratified until 1992.
Right. That one was. And one of them's never been ratified.
Yeah, there's one that's remaining.
Because it was a very bad idea, which it defined how many people would be represented by one representative. And they had no notion of how large the population would become. So the House of Representatives would be, you can do the math.
It would be huge.
It would be huge. So that was not a good idea.
So 12 were proposed by Congress.
Right.
10 got ratified as the Bill of Rights.
some of them later than others by certain states, but they were the Bill of Rights effective 1791. And then that 11th one was, which has to do with not raising salaries
while you're in office.
While you're in
office,
you
can't raise your own salary.
That was not actually ratified till 1992.
Right,
but which is why modern constitutional amendments typically have a time limit on them.
Right.
Yeah, because you don't want this hanging around there, you know, ratified 200 years from now.
Though clearly that one resonated with people.
It took a while, but
it did.
Exactly
so.
Right.
So I think that's kind of, those are kind of interesting points.
Yes, they are. And in fact, that's why the numbering is off. I mean, you looked for the Fifth Amendment and you don't necessarily find it under number
five. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's something that I only learned when I came here. So that
right.
I'll share that with your listeners. There's another interesting story, and I don't know if you have time
please,
for this.
Please.
As you mentioned, a ratification copy of the Bill of Rights went to each of the then states. And some of them voted on it and wrote something back on paper. But one state, Delaware, said, you know, there's actually some blank parchment on the bottom of this, and parchment's not cheap. Let's write that we ratified it on the bottom of the notification.
Uh-huh.
And they did that, and they sent it back to the U.S. government, whereby it became a notification of ratification.
Right.
And it, as such, a federal government document.
So they lost it.
Well, and so we have a bit of a story of Judgment of Solomon. Technically, the top part was what was sent to them, but
right.
the bottom part was what was sent to the federal government.
Right.
And there has been some sentiment that the top part should go back to Delaware, but of course...
No, nobody's going to cut that thing in half.
No.
There's no dotted line there.
King Solomon, I'm sure, would say that was not a good idea.
Well, I talk about being penny wise and pound foolish. They saved a little bit of money on the not having to have any more parchment, but they gave up an important document.
I'm not going to pass judgment on their
Oh, I'd have no problem with passing judgment. I think that was just silly.
It's a little like sometimes people do
right.
that. They receive a letter and they just scrawl on the bottom, okay,
right,
or, you know, do this, make it happen.
Of course, these days you can make a Xerox copy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in those days, they didn't have that. I just think it's an interesting situation. And as a result, and I'll just put a mention in for our friends in Delaware, the state of Delaware has worked out an arrangement. We do lend that document to the Delaware State Archives,
mm-hmm.
and it's on exhibit each year for a limited period of time, and that allows them to have it available to their citizens, and then it comes back to the National Archives.
That is much better than cutting
it in
pieces.
So we think that's a very wise judgment, worthy of Solomon.
Very worthy indeed. All right. Anything else, Kitty?
I think that's probably it. I will mention, I hope people will come here, that the wonderful murals in the rotunda, which are, of course, imaginary portrayals of the founding fathers, it is all men, and the one on the left is the Declaration with Jefferson holding a scroll, and Jefferson's a little taller than anybody.
Right.
Wonderful. And then on this side, it's the mural of the Constitution with George Washington, who in the center, again, a little taller than everyone else.
Of course.
And these were painted by a man named Barry Faulkner and were installed in the rotunda in the 1930s. They were painted specifically for this location. And Faulkner said he worked very hard to find likenesses for each of these people. He said some of them, not even their mothers, would have recognized what he had to paint because he didn't. Some of them, there just were no portraits to work from.
Right.
But we know who they all are, and I think they're grand. They kind of look down on us, and there's a sense
they are absolutely gorgeous.
An august company, you know, inspiring us to greater civic awareness. And
well, they are definitely heroic pictures, and definitely what you call sort of staged pictures, but it seems appropriate.
It is
appropriate. You know,
it's appropriate
in this context. And those people probably never struck those particular poses. Many of them are very recognizable. You can see Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, absolutely.
You can see a lot of other things. Now, I've also heard it said that one of the clouds supposedly looks like a silhouette of Lincoln, or is that just apocryphal?
You know, I have not heard that. That's a good question.
Yeah, it's the cloud directly above Thomas Jefferson's head
that
supposedly...
That's Lincoln.
It's Lincoln's profile looking upward, his eye to the left and his jaw to the right.
I do see it. Well, yeah. I have learned something today.
Well, see, we're all learning. There's always something more to learn about the Constitution
Isn't
and about
that
our founding
something?
Documents. Yeah, for those of you who actually come here and make the trip, you look right, find Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration picture, look directly above him. There's a dark cloud, and it looks like Abraham Lincoln
looking upward with his eye to the left and his jaw to the right. Now, well, I don't know if that really, I mean, it sure looks like him.
I don't know either. It could be coincidence. I've never seen a mention. We know some of what Barry Faulkner has said about the paintings, and I don't think he ever mentioned it.
Well,
but who knows?
Who
knows? Something to look for.
It is something to look for. Well, is that it, Kitty? Are we about...
I think that's probably it.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And once again, what is your website and how can people...
The website is www.archives, with an S on the end, .gov.
Okay.
And it's a great website. There are lots of great images. There are great stories about the Constitution. Many, many things that I think people would be intrigued by.
Every American should come.
Everyone should come.
And everybody else is cordially invited.
Yes.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much,
okay,
Kitty.
You're
for
welcome.
Your time.
Okay.
Great. Great.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're on a field trip to the National Archives. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to some of the people I met there on the day I visited.
The preamble to the Constitution.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're at the National Archives looking at the U.S. Constitution. And you know, when you look at the Constitution, it's hard to miss the fellow who's looking at you to make sure that you don't violate any rules. And that, of course, is the guard standing right next to the document. So I spoke to the guard when I was there and asked him how he felt about his job.
My name is Paul, and it's an honor to stand by the Constitution of the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an exciting experience seeing a lot of people coming here to see the Constitution for the first time. They get excited and they feel this is an inspirational document.
Right.
And it's an honor to stand by the Constitution and watch all the people come here every day from different parts of the United States and the entire world.
Well, what is your what's your favorite reaction you've seen among people who have seen the Constitution for the first time?
Amazement.
Amazement, really?
Right. So I feel quite excited also.
Okay.
Standing by the document signed by popular people like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
James Madison, Gouverneur Morris, John Dickinson,
right.
Alexander Hamilton, who was king. You know, it's quite...
Now, does anybody ever get too excited? Do you ever have to tell them to step back?
People shed tears, you know. Wow. They can't believe they are standing by the United States Constitution, the original Constitution
right.
of the United States. Yeah.
Good. Any little kids ever try to climb up on top of it or anything?
No, we tell them not to. Sometimes they get excited. They feel like, you know, touching
right.
the glass. And
right. You're not supposed to touch the glass, right?
You're not supposed to, yeah.
Okay.
I
understand. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Okay.
Okay.
Next, I saw a little girl there with her father.
My name is Megan, and it was just an amazing experience to see the actual... Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
I see. How old are you, Megan?
10.
Okay. Now, do you know what the Declaration and the Constitution do? What's the difference between the Declaration and the Constitution? Do you know?
No.
You do? Okay. Well, maybe you'll learn that today, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. And Dad, did you want to say something about it, too?
I was a history major in college, and,
right.
you know, reading and studying these documents, and... It's just absolutely amazing the difference in looking at them in a book and coming here and seeing the actual physical documents.
Right.
You know, I wish we were able to take pictures and whatnot, but I understand because of the how delicate that they are.
Right.
But it's just it blows you away.
It
does. Really does.
It gives you chills, doesn't
and
it?
And the fact that, you know, 3/4 of the world have patterned their government off of these documents
right.
speaks to how smart our founding fathers were.
Uh-huh.
And they were, you know, farmers and... silversmiths and whatnot,
uh-huh.
and not career politicians and maybe the guys a couple miles over need to remember that.
I see. All right, Megan. Any other thoughts? Do you think your dad knows what he's talking about?
Yes.
He does. He does. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Well, thank you very much for talking to me, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay.
There were lots of families in the rotunda of the National Archives that day, so the last people I spoke to were a mother and her teenage daughter.
Okay, I'm here with another citizen who has seen the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights today, and could you tell us who you are and what you think of all this?
Sure, my name's Heather, and I'm from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Right.
I think my teenage daughter said it best, and she just said these men were so smart.
Uh-huh.
And it was just really neat to see how a group of educated men that really sought truth and knowledge and brought their life experiences to the table were just able to bring about these documents that have guided us for 200 plus years. It's just, it is really neat seeing the real thing.
It is. Is this your first time seeing them?
Yes.
I see. And is this your teenage daughter next to you?
This is my 14-year-old.
Does she want to say anything? Is your mom giving us the straight story?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. Well, did you learn anything today, or tell me about your experience today?
I thought it was cool to, like, finally see all the stuff that you've been hearing about your whole life and you've been taught, like, just about at school. And I just thought it was cool to finally see it.
What did you find most interesting, the Constitution or the Declaration or the Bill of Rights or what?
Constitution.
How come?
Because it was legible. You can read it.
That's important, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Were you disappointed with the Declaration?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just talking to the person who's in charge of preserving the documents, and it's a real pity that the Declaration's in such bad shape, but thank heaven they did a better job with the Constitution, right?
Yes, I was wondering about that. I didn't get to read anything about why that stood up to the test.
Well, the story I've heard is that it was just a more popular document and therefore was displayed a lot more than the Constitution was during the first 100 years or so, and sometimes in sunlight.
Okay.
And the sunlight and the exposure to the oxygen in the atmosphere just made it all fade much more quickly. In fact, it's apparently pretty much the same construction as the Constitution, so I think it's a pretty good indicator of what the Constitution would look like if it hadn't been so carefully preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, any other thoughts, ladies?
I don't think so.
That's about it.
It was cool.
It was cool. Okay, and I didn't catch your name.
Maddie.
Okay, Maddie. Well, watch the Facebook page, and maybe you'll be on in a few weeks. Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate your time, ladies.
And so 14-year-old Maddie will have the last word on my visit to the National Archives. It was cool. And indeed it was cool, and I sincerely hope that each and every one of you will go and visit and see the U.S. Constitution for yourself. I promise you, you'll never forget it. Hey, we've got a little bit of time left, and so now we'll have a brief feature that we do from time to time. We call it one of our constitutional stories.
Well, tell me what you want to hear. Something that will light those ears.
Today, I'm going to tell you a story about my friend Earl. Earl was a heck of a guy. He was born a long time ago. He was born in March in 1891 and died in July of 1974. But between those two dates, he did some pretty amazing things. He managed to go to college in a day when not very many people went to college. He went to law school in a time where very few people went to law school. He did it very quickly, too. Only a few years it took him to get through law school, less time than most people take. And embarked on a career out in his home state of California. He was starting out as a successful lawyer, but then he felt the call of duty during the Great War, the First World War. So he joined the Army. He became a first lieutenant in the United States Army, served honorably during that conflict. But it didn't last that long, only a little over a year from the U.S. perspective. And so when the war was over, he went back to his practice of law, took a job back in his hometown, and very soon, just within a very few years, came to the attention of the local powers that be, and so was appointed the local prosecuting attorney in Alameda County, California, at a very tender age in his late 20s. Earl was so good at his job that everybody loved him. In fact, there was one poll that was taken long about this time where people selected him as the best district attorney in the United States. I didn't even know there was such a poll that was taken. I didn't know there was such a contest. But apparently, a lot of people thought he was the very best one there. And so it made sense that after just a few more years, he ran and won as a Republican candidate for the governorship of the state of California. Now, he'd been very much a law and order type of guy as a district attorney, and he was very much a law and order type of guy when he began as governor of California because, well, it was a time when law and order was a very important thing. You see, he took office in early 1943 during World War II, and this was just when California was particularly concerned about one part of its citizenry. It was particularly concerned about Japanese Americans. In fact, it was so concerned about Japanese Americans who lived near the West Coast that by and large, it had carted them all off to internment camps in other parts of the nation. And Earl, being the law and order type of guy that he was a big supporter of that plan. Earl was reelected twice to the governorship. In fact, he was the only person who's ever been elected three times as governor of California. And in the second time he was elected, under the particular nominating system the state of California had, he was actually both the Republican and the Democratic nominee for the position. I mean, he was a juggernaut. Everybody loved Earl. In fact, they loved him so much that he ran as a vice presidential candidate when Thomas Dewey was the Republican's presidential candidate in 1948. And everybody expected Dewey and his friend Earl to win the presidency. Now, you know that he didn't. You know that Truman pulled off a famous upset. So that was a bit disappointing, but it didn't quench Earl's ambition. And in fact, in 1952, at his next opportunity, Earl decided he was going to run again. Well, Earl had a bit of a problem that year, and the problem was that the fellow who was the odds-on favorite to be the Republican presidential nomination, in fact, the fellow who ultimately was the nominee, was a very prominent fellow by the name of Dwight Eisenhower. Now, if anybody could beat Earl, if anybody could beat everybody, it was Dwight Eisenhower. And so Earl realized he probably was not going to be president in 1952. So he figured he'd be a favorite son candidate, and maybe he'd broker a good deal for the state of California or for himself. He was almost thwarted by another Californian who also had designs on getting a position on that ticket or getting a good deal, a fellow you may have heard of by the name of Richard Nixon, who was a senator from California then and who ultimately was Dwight Eisenhower's running mate and ultimately became vice president and later president, and you all know the rest of that particular story. But Earl, nonetheless, held just enough influence, enough power within the Republican Party that Eisenhower did broker a deal with him. And the deal went like this. Dwight said to Earl, "If you will support me for president, then I will give you the next available appointment on the United States Supreme Court." That's a pretty good deal. And Earl grabbed it. What nobody knew then was that the next available appointment was going to be the chief justiceship. A fellow by the name of Fred Vinson had been chief justice for a number of years, and he died unexpectedly in the fall of 1953, right after Eisenhower took office. And here's another little anecdote. The story goes that Fred Vinson was held in such low regard by his colleagues on the court that one of them said at Vinson's funeral that Vinson's death was the first definitive proof that this justice had ever seen of the existence of a supreme being. Be that as it may, there was an opening. It was for the chief justiceship. But White's people were not particularly thrilled about the idea of giving Earl the chief justiceship, but nonetheless, they'd made a deal. Earl insisted upon it, and they honored it. So in 1954, early in 1954, Earl was appointed Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Now, the very first case, the first major case that Earl encountered was one that you probably have heard of, involving segregated public schools. Yes, of course, I'm talking about the famous Brown versus Board of Education. And Earl, in his new position as the leader of the Supreme Court, not only convinced a majority of that court to overturn existing separate but equal precedents and declare segregation unconstitutional, not only did he do that, but he convinced every single member of the court, a unanimous court, to vote with him. He felt that was important because it was such a momentous decision. And that was just the beginning, because for the next 16 years, almost 16 years, Earl led a liberal revolution in American constitutional law. Well, you know who I'm talking about now, don't you? You know that Earl's last name was Warren, and he became the leader of the Warren Court, the very same court that not only abolished school segregation, but the same court that abolished school prayer, the same court that radically expanded the rights of criminal defendants, the same court that essentially remade American constitutional law in the 1950s and 60s. Earl Warren, the conservative law and order district attorney, the conservative governor of California who had supported the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II, when he got on the Supreme Court, he showed his true colors. And that's why years later, when Dwight Eisenhower reflected upon his time as president, he called the appointment of Earl Warren the biggest mistake of his presidency. You can decide for yourself whether you think the Warren Court was a good thing or a bad thing, but nobody can deny that Earl, the conservative Republican from California, was among the great figures in 20th century American constitutional law.
American born, 35 years of age or more. The rest of the article says what being president's about, his powers, his duties, and how we can kick him out. He's commander in chief of all the military. But let's get to Article 3 about the judiciary. It sets up the court supreme with justices regarded in the highest esteem. They serve for life during all four seasons. And Article 3, it also defines treason. Now we got three.
And that's our show. I'd like to thank Laura Diachenko and Kitty Nicholson of the National Archives for all of the time they spent with me. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Next we got Article 4. It mandates that the laws of one state are honored by the other states. It also promises full protections against invasions or insurrections. Article 5.
Hey, the Constitution may be more than 200 years old, but we're brand new and we're hip. We are technically savvy, and we know you are too. So if you'd like to visit us on Facebook, please feel free. Just type in your weekly constitutional. We're also on iTunes. We're on Twitter. And we're everywhere on the internet. Just type our name into a search engine and see what you come up with.
Approved, then we can use it. Now every single one of them said it was okay. So the Constitution survives into the present day. Now we've gone through the articles 1 through 7. We went kind of fast. So if you have any questions, go back to the top. Even make your own edits a couple of times through. I know you're going to get it.
What does the Constitution do? What does the Constitution say?